Julie Godin is policy counsel for federal legislation and is responsible for advancing the center's the Center for Reproductive Rights U.S. policy objectives in Washington, D.C. Before joining the center, Julie spent 8 years as a healthcare attorney. From 2004 to 2007, she served on a task force of the American Health Lawyers Association that focused on legal preparedness for public health or other emergencies and published two guides for healthcare clients to assist in their legal emergency preparedness planning. Before practicing law, Julie worked at several healthcare nonprofit associations, including what is now America's Health Insurance Plans, the National Business Group on Health, and the Jacobs Institute of Women's Health. She received her law degree from the Georgetown University Law Center and also holds a doctorate in political science from the American University. Dr. Godin has also taught at American, Johns Hopkins, and Georgetown universities. Welcome.
Thanks, Blair. Hopefully I'll be able to go forward and won't need to go backwards.
Sorry.
With these. No, you've got me nervous now that I'm going to be jumping all over the place. Okay. As was mentioned, I'm with the Center for Reproductive Rights. For those of you who aren't familiar with us, we're nearly 20 years old. Our anniversary is next year. And we're primarily known as a litigating organization. We file challenges to state laws that we believe improperly restrict access to reproductive rights, including abortion. I'm actually part of the small D.C. office of CRR. Most of our folks are up in New York. And down here we work on, as Blair mentioned, federal policy issues. Before I get into the research that I'm going to present, I just wanted to spend a few minutes talking, picking up actually where Sarah left off, about the new contraceptive coverage mandate and the proposed religious exemption to it, because that's actually where the public debate around refusals is right now. And as was mentioned, it's happening tomorrow. There was actually a hearing last week also about the state of religious freedom in the United States today, and tomorrow is focusing specifically on conscience, which we in this community tend to refer to as refusal clauses, and how that impacts healthcare. So when the mandate for the Women's Preventive Services came out in August, the bishops were pretty quick out of the box to file their comments on the proposed religious exemption, and it was a pretty long sort of exegesis on why the proposed religious exemption was too narrow and why it needed to be considerably broadened. Actually, their first statement was that there should be no contraceptive mandate because it's not preventive health care, but if there's going to be a mandate, there needs to be a much broader religious exemption. We were particularly concerned that this was essentially kind of a signal that litigation could ensue over this mandate if it's not broadened, and so we put in our own set of comments to try to refute some of the arguments that the bishops were making about why the arguments they were making that a refusal clause needed to be broadened and was in fact required under the law, because we don't think that it is. Our comments really had two themes to them. One was the public health rationale for the contraceptive coverage mandate, and the other was the fact that current religion clause jurisprudence does not require any exemption whatsoever. And as mentioned, there's going to be a hearing tomorrow, which I think will be very interesting. I'm planning to be in line for that a little bit early. So the public health rationale, just real quickly, and I don't really need to tell probably most folks here why prevention of unintended pregnancy is a key part of public health, but we felt that that really needed to be reiterated for HHS as they were considering whether to have a broader religious refusal. One of the statements that the bishops made was, well, pregnancy is not a disease, therefore preventing it is not part of preventive health care. I don't think we here need to spend a whole lot of time on that, but we did take that on in our comments. What we said, and there's a reason I'm using a term of art here, government has a compelling interest in reducing unintended pregnancy, and that compelling interest becomes important when we talk about the law. We know that half of pregnancies in this country are unintended. There are a lot of risks associated with that to women, and if they carry the pregnancy to term, to the infant, because if a woman doesn't know she's pregnant, she can't take steps to ensure that the pregnancy will be healthy, socioeconomic impacts, and of course it leads to a higher incidence of abortion. So we kind of tried to summarize the public health and clinical data for why prevention of unintended pregnancy was in fact so important. Now I probably just jumped ahead of myself, but that's okay. We noted that prevention of unintended pregnancy is firmly embedded in the nation's prevention agenda, and that what the HHS was doing was not radical, but it was in fact quite mainstream, and that we need to have no cost sharing for the full range of methods, because the more long-acting reversible methods are the most effective, but some of the most expensive, and they require the intervention of a clinician, and so it was really important that all methods be covered. So the second theme of our comments was, you, HHS, don't need to have a religious exemption to this mandate, either under the First Amendment or under statutory law. The first argument was the First Amendment. Neutral, generally applicable laws like this that are not designed to burden religion are okay, even if it incidentally burdens somebody's religious beliefs. So you may not believe in contraception, you don't have to use it, but that doesn't mean you get to opt out of providing it for your employees. And as Sarah mentioned, most Catholics actually use contraception. It's just the sort of church hierarchy that wants to claim that no Catholics do. And so we again wanted to emphasize that this is a public health issue and that we shouldn't be listening to a doctrinaire reason to be backing away from a public health mandate. The other religion argument comes from the Religious Freedom Restoration Act, which was a statute passed in 1993 that restored strict scrutiny to public to laws that are considered to infringe on the exercise of religion. We argue that, first of all, we don't even think RFRA, as it's affectionately known, applies here, because requiring employers to cover contraception does not burden the exercise of religion. Participating in sex without contraception is not, as far as I'm aware, part of Catholic doctrine. And that's essentially what you would how you would have to frame it to say that requiring contraceptive coverage burdens the exercise of religion. And opposition to contraception is a belief. It's not part of the exercise of religion. Usually when courts look at stuff like this, they look at acts like ceremonies and gatherings that constitute exercise, but believing that people shouldn't use contraception is not the exercise of religion, and therefore requiring coverage does not burden the exercise of religion. So, and that's important. We want to really, a part of the theme here is to figure out how we can better message sort of our side of this debate and the distinction between belief and exercise in the context of discussing religion is important, and we'll get back to that a little bit later. We say, now, if RFRA is going to apply, we meet both prongs of the test under that the mandate, the contraceptive coverage mandate, serves a compelling interest for all the reasons that we know, and it is the least restrictive means of furthering that interest. People don't get to opt out of neutral laws simply because they don't like what the law stands for or what it does. You don't get to not pay taxes because you don't like that we intervene abroad with our military. And this is sort of, we're trying to draw that analogy. And again, the mandate doesn't require anybody to actually use contraception, nor does it infringe on the free speech rights of Catholics who want to tell other Catholics, don't use it, you shouldn't use this stuff. That's fine. But as far as insurance coverage goes, it's important that the mandate is comprehensive. So again, I wanted to put this out here because I think it presents some key themes to frame the debate about religious restrictions on care. Again, belief versus behavior. And as I think Sarah touched on too, who has a conscience? Part of what we're trying to also inject into the debate is that while individuals may have beliefs and consciences, institutions do not. Institutions are collections of individuals. And healthcare institutions should not be able to adopt the beliefs of some and impose them on their employees or on their clinicians who are providing patient care. As was mentioned, we don't think the Catholic hierarchy speaks for most Catholics on this particular issue, and that in this case, public health concerns should trump these various very tenuous threats to conscience that are being raised. And of course, we again use the word refusal instead of conscience, because conscience seems to have been co-opted by those who want to restrict and deny care. And we're trying to sort of take that back a little bit. So what I was going to talk about now is some fact-finding that was done by our organization. I'm going to have to apologize a little bit in advance because I was not the one who actually conducted the research. It was done by some folks who are not with the organization anymore, so I'm going to have to put that caveat on it that for some of the nitty-gritty methodological details, I'm going to have to take a pass. And this is still a little bit raw material at this point. We haven't published it yet, but we wanted to kind of get this out there because it fits very well with the theme of this panel. And I think, as Lois and I were describing or talking about earlier, we have anecdotal information about things that are happening to patients here and there, and we wanted to drill down a little bit and see really more what was going on. So what was done here is we looked at, and I'm going to use we kind of loosely, because as I just said, I wasn't part of the research team, Three hospitals were chosen that had been secular and then were taken over by a Catholic institution, and so we were really trying to look at what happens to the delivery of care when that happens in these three communities. So you see here the hospitals that were selected. Sierra Vista is a rural hospital. The other two are in urban settings. West Suburban is just outside Chicago on the west side, and then the other one is in Michigan. So these hospitals, these communities, were somewhat geographically isolated. There were limited choice of places to go for patients in those communities. And part of the thing, one of the sort of striking findings was the reach of the directives. It wasn't just at the hospital, but if there were provider groups that had their offices on the hospital campus, the directives also applied to them. It actually dictated things that could be discussed anywhere on the grounds of the hospital, hospitals that were now under the ERDs that that Sarah helpfully walked us through. Okay, so what we did, we wanted to look at the impact of the directives on six specific areas of reproductive care: miscarriage management, abortion, ectopic pregnancy treatment, tubal sterilization, and then regular contraception, and then emergency contraception sort of in a distinct way. So in terms of miscarriage management, I'm not going to drill down into what the directives do and don't say. Sarah touched on that, but all of the clinicians, and I should say that the interviews, there were nearly 50 interviews, and they were with both clinicians and with patients. So we're trying to get sort of both sides of the experience here. All of the clinicians interviewed from all of these hospitals said that they were not permitted to perform a uterine evacuation to complete a miscarriage if there was a fetal heartbeat present. And I need to really pick up the pace here. There was also just a lot of uncertainty about what exactly the new policies were. That was sort of a theme that we found, too, that in areas where there was some ambiguity around the directives, the hospitals were not very good at communicating to the providers what they could and couldn't do in certain situations. And so providers were unsure whether they needed to get an ethical consult, whether they had to refer a patient, things like that. I do have some vignettes that I was going to read, but in the interest of time, I'm not going to do that because I won't get through nearly all of this, so I apologize. But again, we will be publishing this work eventually. Some providers even talked about, in the context of miscarriage management, having actually falsifying records in order to meet the criteria that the hospitals had put in place so that they could actually qualify to do the care that they thought was required. Now, abortion, I think we know we're pretty clear on what the Catholic stance on that is. All of the hospitals investigated here did allow it in the case where the pregnant woman's life was in danger, but again, the providers were not sure what qualified, you know, how much in danger the woman's life had to be. We've heard stories of a couple of actually hospital employees, both of whom had anencephalic fetuses, who had to go elsewhere to get an abortion because they were denied when they asked if they could have it at the facility at which they worked. Critically, employees of the hospital, until they were in that situation, did not know that they wouldn't be able to have an abortion there, and it's very unlikely that the patients who were coming there would know that either. If even the employees were not sure what the policies were, it's pretty certain that the patients were not either. We looked at ectopic pregnancy. There was, again, a lot of ambiguity, and it presented some real ethical dilemmas for providers who had patients in that situation, and they all talked about practicing under the fear of future sanctions, even if they didn't happen right away. In terms of tubal sterilization, overwhelmingly the physicians said that this was the most significant change in women's access to reproductive health care after the directives were adopted. These were providers serving women who were largely underserved, even if they had a number of children and future pregnancies were contraindicated for medical reasons. The doctors were not allowed to perform tubal sterilizations following a delivery, which is when ideally you'd want to do it so that you don't have to have a second surgery. Some women who did know in advance chose to go outside their communities and deliver elsewhere so they could have the sterilization right away. Others simply couldn't and had to go, again, later someplace else to have a second surgery, putting them at greater medical risk. All right, so I'm going to try to skip forward a little bit. Contraception is not permitted under the directives, and this impacted both patients and employees. This mostly affected women who were in clinics or doctor's offices that were under the control of the hospitals, because obviously this isn't an inpatient issue, but it does provide a barrier to women seeking care. And for emergency contraception, it was no longer available at West Suburban after it was taken over by Resurrection Health. And this affected both the emergency department physicians who would have otherwise administered it, as well as some local pharmacies who also stopped providing it. I'm going to skip. These are really just kind of summary slides as to the overall impact that we're seeing. Treatment options being banned, limits that were not medical but religious directives, as Sarah touched on earlier, and then the impact on women. So we have a problem in our laws, because we have federal laws that require hospitals to provide treatment in the case of EMTALA, emergency care, or require hospitals who want to participate in Medicare and Medicaid, which is to say all of them, have to meet certain standards of care, and yet we also have many refusal laws at the federal level, many at the state level too, that allow institutions who supposedly have consciences not to provide the standard of care. And so this is obviously a significant conflict, and as was mentioned earlier, I'm hoping that at the end we'll have something a little bit more positive by Lois to end our discussion on. And I think I'll have to probably stop there, since I saw the 1-minute sign, and I'll maybe get to some of the rest of it during questions. Thanks.